Success seems to be a very deep mystery to many people. How is it that some succeed and others don't? In truth, it really isn't a mystery, and it isn't all that difficult. Success involves good decisions, good habits, and hard work. People who are successful have two habits that help them to be successful, and I'd like to enumerate those and talk about them this afternoon. And it ties in with the statement or two made in the first split sermon. The title of my sermon is Lifestyle and Seven Generations. Lifestyle and seven generations. People who are successful have two habits that help them to be successful. One, they have a long-term view of life and how to live it. And two, they know, and they know in their heart, that any endeavor has guidelines to follow. That seems to be a mystery to many people. But the truth, and it's very simple, there are guidelines in every company, every endeavor, guidelines to follow. And to be successful, one has to live by those guidelines. In other words, if they want to follow those guidelines, they have to make appropriate choices. So success is good decisions, good habits, and hard work, including a long-term view. It isn't a quick fix thing that we do today. You may or may not realize that we as Christians are what is called futuristic people. You may not realize you're a futuristic person, but we are futuristic people. That is, we look to the future. We try not to look to the past. The doctrine that we teach is called the good news of the kingdom of God. We're forward-looking people, and we try to get rid of the past and move forward to the future. We are a futuristic people, that is, we look to the future. When we make decisions, how far ahead should we look, or do we look? How far ahead should we look? And in actuality, how far ahead do we really look? One day? 1 week? 1 month? 1 year? Do you dare look 10 years out into the future? Do you look a whole generation, whether 30 or 40 years? Would it be unthinkable in making your decisions that you look 100 years into the future? Would it be preposterous to even think about looking 1,000 years ahead into the future when you make decisions? And on top of that, or in connection with that, when we make decisions and looking to the future, are we considering only ourselves, or are all those others who will follow us in our footsteps to consider also? Lifestyle and seven generations. Before the Feast of Tabernacles several years ago, I'd gone to Downers Grove, Illinois, west of where we lived in Crown Point, Indiana. I went there to get an I-pass for the Illinois toll roads. Makes it a lot easier. You can whiz by at 70 miles an hour on the toll road, and you can see these 15 or 20 trucks lined up on the other lane waiting to get there to pay their fee on the toll road. And I really enjoyed that. So I'd gone to Downers Grove to get an I-pass. And I was traveling along on Ogden Street going in that direction, and I noticed that there was a Trader Joe's. Well, Delia and I used to shop at Trader Joe's in Pasadena, California, when we were there in 1970 for a sabbatical. So I thought I'd stop by Trader Joe's and see what they had. And inside the store, I was cruising along the aisles at a pretty good pace for me, being a slow-moving man. And I stopped at the soap and detergent department or section. I was looking at the different boxes of detergents, and one box caught my attention very quickly because the label said, Seventh Generation Laundry Detergent. Seventh Generation Laundry Detergent? It was certified to be free of various chemicals in order not to harm the ecology, not to harm the streams, rivers, lakes, and waters. In other words, those who made seventh generation laundry detergent were looking ahead to the ecology and perhaps even the economy of our beloved nation. Well, I was also surprised and attracted to the statement. On the box was a quote from the great law of the Iroquois Indian Confederation. The quote stopped me dead in my tracks because it said, and here's the quote, "In our every deliberation, we must consider the impact of our decisions on the next seven generations." Talk about long term. What a profound statement. Let me read it again because it is a profound statement and takes a while to really grasp it. Their great law said, in our every deliberation, which means in our decisions that we make in life, in our every deliberation, we must consider the impact of our decisions on the next seven generations. Some of us don't even realize that our decisions will have an impact on the next generation. And we don't even think of the next generation. We just do it. Perhaps you've heard this, but certain of America's problems are said to be, and by problems I mean teen pregnancies, drug abuse, men who batter their wives, welfare, debt of all kinds. Certain of America's problems are said to be generational. I'm sure you've heard that. And we batter back and forth the talking about generational, and we even laugh at it. Oh yeah, but do we think of the seriousness of it and how much that word affects our life if we're not careful of thinking of how many generations our decision will affect? Generational, that is the effects of past actions are passed along from one generation to another. What a pity. But it's true. As I said, teen pregnancies. Often it happens generation after generation after generation. Drug abuse. Often it is generational. The children see the parents, they pass it along to their children. Men who batter their wives. It happens generation after generation. Welfare, they never get out of the welfare syndrome. Debt of all kinds. It's passed along, the habits of spending. How many people live their lives? I'm sorry. How many people's lives have been affected by the decisions of those who went before them? I know mine has been. I know of several things in my life that I am paying the price of what my parents and grandparents did. Delee knows in her life that her life is affected by decisions made by her father and mother, and who knows how many other relatives in the past affected her life. They laugh about some of them, but it isn't laughable, and she knows that. Mine has been, Delee's has been, and I'm sure that many of you in this room have, if you look back honestly, can see in your life where your life has been affected because of the decisions of your parents and others before you, and they did not or were not thinking of you when they made that decision. They were not considering generationalism. The decisions and the actions of each generation affect the decisions and actions of the next generation as that generation comes along. As I said, we call it generational. And it seems to be automatic in many cases. You can count on it. You know it's going to be that way. Well, the Iroquois Indians had a great law that made that profound statement that stopped me. But do you realize that one of God, the eternal gods, the creator and ruler of the universe, one of his great laws says that it will be that way also? Generational. One of his laws says that. Let's look at God's law in Exodus, and we'll see what he says about this subject. And maybe it'll be more profound for us when we see that it isn't just something that psychologists talk about, but it's something that God said, and it has relationship to his laws and our decisions, and the light of those laws will be in our lives generation after generation. Let's go to which chapter did I say? Are you there already? Exodus 20, and you can read it in Deuteronomy 5. Exodus chapter 20. And we will start in verse 3. When God called a people, the Israelites, he also gave to them his law. 10 simple laws. And one of them said this, beginning in verse 3. Do not have any other gods instead of me. Surely people don't do that, do they? Yes, they do. They may not realize it, but they are worshiping certain things. And your God influences your life and the lives of your children. That's the first commandment. Don't have any other gods. Now, we know there's only one true one, but many have what's called false gods, and they devote their life to those false gods and images. Verse 4 says, in addition to not having any other gods as far as actual beings or entities, in addition to that, you shall not make for yourselves a carved image, totem pole, some other idol that you make out of wood or stone or steel, and you put it up and you look to that. You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that's in heaven above, the earth beneath, or the water under the earth. And then in verse 5, and this is the key, because if we followed this explicitly, we would never have a camera. Because a camera takes pictures or images of people and places and things. The key is not necessarily, although it's not a good thing to have images of some things, but the key is it said you shall not bow down to this image and you shall not serve it. Of course, the logical question would be why? What difference does it make? What difference does it make if we do bow down to an image and serve it instead of the true God? Which, of course, would involve our decisions, our choices. Well, for starters, if we bow down to this false image of a God, we're going to receive wrong information, because that idol that we carved out of something does not give us correct information. We will have wrong guidelines. It will cause us to go in a wrong direction. And it will also cause us to have a wrong lifestyle. And in addition to all of that, if we do bow down to this image of whatever it is we have before us that we call God and worship as God, our decisions and our actions will influence the lifestyle of those who come after us by just naturally. God warns us in advance how we should think about making this decision, who it will affect, and why it is not wise to make that choice. Let's look in verse 5 where God warns us, the middle of the verse, after don't bow down and don't serve them, because I'm the Lord your God. There's only one, I'm He. And it says, and I will say here, it seems to say that God fiendishly delights in causing people to suffer. And so it is God Himself who is making those people suffer. Because it says in the King James, I'm a jealous God, you've angered me, I'm mad at you, I'm very jealous, and I'm going to visit the iniquity, which means wrong choices, wrong decisions, wrong lifestyle. I'm going to visit your iniquities the iniquities of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation. I'm going to take it out on you, and you're going to wish you'd never done that. Your children are going to suffer, and I'm going to make sure it does. Now, it makes it sound like that God is this evil God, and he really delights in causing the next generation to suffer. Because the next generation does suffer. It is generational. It said to the third and fourth generations. And sometimes people realize it takes sometimes 2, 3, maybe even 4 generations until one can finally break that pattern and then move on by making right choices. God warns us about this, and it has to do with our decisions and our God and the way we honor or dishonor the true God in our decisions. Lifestyle, 7 generations. As I said, it seems to say that God himself inflicts the damages. But God really doesn't have to do anything for that to happen, because by living contrary to God's standards, and remember I said success involves realizing that there are rules, certain rules, in everything we do. And the person who is angry at rules does not understand God's truth and the wonderful goodness of life that God gives, because no matter where you go and what you get involved in, you're going to find that there are some rules. And if you're going to, as God said to the Apostle Paul, why do you kick at the bricks? Why are you doing this? Don't you know you're going to suffer by doing this? Some people lose their jobs because they just won't follow the guidelines. They're talented, but they don't understand that principle. By living contrary to God's standards, we certainly show great disrespect to God. And he says that when you do that, then you're going to have wrong information, make wrong decisions, you're living by wrong guidelines, and those who follow in your footsteps as your children and grandchildren are going to suffer the consequences of what you did. It isn't that God hates us at all. He loves us dearly. But he knows that if we don't follow the guidelines, then we're going to suffer and suffer and suffer. So he warns us in advance, don't do this. That's what he told our great-great-great-great-great-grandmother Eve. Leave that alone. It's going to cause you trouble. God doesn't have to do anything as far as passing along the penalties. As we grow up, we learn from our home. We watch our father and our mother. We watch our older brother and older sisters. The home teaches us. The school we go to teaches us. The people around us teach us. We are influenced by those. They are our first teachers. And we learn from them and we copy from them. And so we have a lifestyle similar to theirs because we are looking at them rather than the right rules. Each generation is influenced by what it sees at home. It is influenced by what it sees at school. It is influenced by what they see in this society. God does not have to do anything. But he tells us that what we do will affect others to the third and the fourth generation. That should stop us in our tracks as a parent to realize, you know, I better think this through a little more if I want my children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren. I've been thinking about that 7th generation laundry detergent. You know, if I go back 7 generations, that takes me back to the 1600s maybe. I don't know what's a generation, 40 years. That's 40 times 7, that's 280, right at 300 years from now. Well, maybe the early 1700s. That someone back there was doing something that would have an influence in my life. And if I do things that I shouldn't, then those people that live 200 to 250 to 300 years from me will be affected to some degree by what I do today, the decisions I make. That should make us think, maybe I don't need to do this. I'd like to do it, but how many other people will it affect? It affects us, God says, to the third and the fourth generation. That's where we get the term generational. And this happens to those who have this image that they look to instead of the true God. Those who don't honor God to the third and fourth generation. In other words, those who live by the wrong rules, the wrong lifestyle. It seems to be automatic that generationalism happens that way. And the pitiful part is that few seem to know that they can break the mold, and few seem to make the effort to break the pattern. Some say, even though they understand that to a degree, they say, what I do is my business. It's my business, and as long as I don't hurt anyone else, that's all right. Well, they don't understand what generationalism is, that it is a living law, the same as gravity, that people will be affected by our decisions, our actions, and our lifestyle. I may have mentioned this before. There were a couple of twin brothers who were brought up in the home, and their father was an alcoholic, shall we say. A very bad alcoholic. And when they grew to be 20, 25, or 30 years old, they were interviewed. And the first one was asked, and he had become an alcoholic himself. And they said, why did you become an alcoholic? And he said, well, with an old man like mine as a father, what do you expect me to be like? And so they asked the second brother, who was a teetotaler, how come you're a teetotaler? He said, well, with an old man like I had as a father, what would you expect me to turn out like? The same thing. Some are affected, some learn, some break the mold, some don't. We must understand what generationalism is, that it is a living law. Those who don't understand that usually have limited vision. Have you ever driven in a snowstorm and your wiper blades are working fast as they can go and you still cannot see very far ahead? That's what it's like when you don't understand generationalism. Why am I having so many troubles? Why are my children having so many troubles? Why are things going so much contrary to what I would really like to have? They have short-term vision. They're not thinking of long-term. Others are affected, and the difficulty is they are affected after the fact. And both the giver and the receiver wonder, why? Why has this happened? Well, I covered some of this last week in what human nature was, how we acquired it. I'd like to cover it a little bit the same from a different perspective when I talk about what we call the Act One of the grand premiere of the first human family. What they did profoundly illustrates this absolute principle. Let's go to Genesis 2 and we'll start in verse 16, where God said what I mentioned. This is religious terminology. I used just normal lifetime terminology and saying that no matter where you are, there are rules. Often we've talked about laws, and somehow law seems to have a negative effect to our thinking that I don't like laws. I like guidelines, but don't talk to me about laws. What's the difference in a sense? It is a restriction, or maybe not a restriction, a lot of latitude in rules or laws. It is our view of it that is the important thing. In chapter 2, verse 16, God commanded human beings, saying, you have broad latitude here. He said, of every tree you can freely eat. You know, when people say, well, there's nothing to eat, I can't have any more pork. That is a stupid statement. There is a multitude of absolutely wonderful foods to eat. God explained here that there were and are company rules. You have a lot of latitude, you have a wide range of opportunities and freedoms, but you see that tree over there? Leave it alone. You're not going to have anything but trouble if you fool with that tree. Leave it alone. Well, in chapter 3, verse 6, you will find that the woman looked at it, and she couldn't see anything wrong with it. And according to her view, which was one of limited experience, it seemed okay to make that a part of their lifestyle. And you will find that she made the decision. Now, as I said, generationalism doesn't just happen. It is the result of decisions. People have made personal choices. And that's what causes generationalism. They make these decisions. Nobody held a gun to their head to make that decision. They personally made that decision. She made the decision to take of this forbidden fruit. And then she made the decision to give it to her husband. And guess what he did? She didn't hold a gun to his head. He then made his choice that he would also partake of this. They, in essence, put another God before the true God. They made decisions contrary to God's guidelines. They didn't have a positive attitude. They may have hated God's guideline. But this is an important point in life, and it is a reason for generationalism. People think that you don't have to follow the rules. I can do anything I want to do. It's my life. I will live my life. And that's true. It is our life. We will live our life. But the sadness of it is we will reap the rewards, if you want to call it that, of making our own choices contrary to God's ways. It is automatic. It is unfailing. It happens all the time. And it goes on generation after generation after generation. And seemingly, no one knows how to break the mold. They could if they would. So I said, we have to look ahead when we make decisions. The law of the Iroquois Indian said that we need to look 7 generations ahead when we make our decisions. We need to be thinking of others 7 generations from now. How far ahead were Adam and Eve looking? Till the next tree that came along they could eat? Had they ever heard the word generational? Did they know who they were dealing with and working with? Did they know there was such a thing as what you plant, you will harvest? Other than themselves, Adam and Eve, who were they considering? How far into the family genealogy were they looking? And the hard question, if they had known the consequences, would they have made the same choice? If they had known that all of mankind would be cut off from God by what they did, would they have made that same choice anyway? As I said, we think that God is the one who is punishing people. He doesn't have to do a thing. We are doing it to ourselves. We do it to ourselves by the decisions and choices that we make, and our decisions and our choices then affect those that come behind us and follow in our tracks. You've heard the term about asking the tough questions. Some people delight in asking the tough questions. Have you ever asked yourself tough questions? We have to. Asking the tough questions and using long-term thinking and long-term vision makes life go much better than, which is And the other side is instant gratification. But if we have long-term vision and we ask the tough questions, life goes a lot better than instant gratification, which is the result of a short-term view. I want this. I want it now. I will have it now. So we get it now. But we don't like the results. Adam and Eve didn't ask the tough questions. But they did use short-term vision. And sure enough, all who followed them had their lives changed as a result of that one family decision. For the next 1,600 years, until Noah, it says one generation got worse than the next. It was so bad, you read in Genesis 6, that God said, I'm ashamed and embarrassed at what I've created. I'm going to destroy it. And he did. They all drowned except for 8 people. Generation after generation, it was just like a row of dominoes. You have them all lined up and you tilt one and it hits the next and the next and the next and the next and the next. And all you have to do is tilt one domino and you can knock down the whole row. You don't have to do a thing after you tilt the first one. God doesn't have to do anything. We do it to ourselves. Adam and Eve tilted that first domino. And for 1,600 years, generationalism ruled. You know, when we see Adam and Eve, I think I'll ask the question, did you shed any tears over what you did all during those 1,600 years? Did you shed any tears over the long-term consequences that came about as a result of what you did? One lousy little sugar-coated apple. One lousy little sugar-coated apple. There is a place in the Bible talking to Christians that says, and it is a warning to us about who we follow, and it says that we should not follow in the way of Cain. Meaning we should not allow his decision, his way of life, his lifestyle, his conclusions to affect our life. You will find that Cain's example is given as a negative point, but it's given to help us learn to think of the welfare of other people. Let's notice this in 1 John 3 and verse 10. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 10. I think we'll be reading the last half of that verse. I would imagine the Apostle John learned this the hard way over the years. This was written in his later years. As a younger man, he and his brother, when the certain group of people didn't do what John and James thought this group said, they said to Jesus, shall we call down fire from heaven and destroy them? I would think he didn't think too much of other people at times, but he became known as the Apostle of Love. He learned that he needs to make decisions and do things properly, thinking of the welfare, not just the deaths of other people. In 1 John 3, and verse 10, and the latter sentence of it says, whoever does not practice doing the right thing is not of God, nor is he who does not think of the welfare of his brother or sister. And then it says in verse 11 that one of the company rules is we should think of the welfare of the other person. And then it adds, not as Cain. Cain didn't like the rules. He didn't live by the rules. He broke the rules and his children afterward suffered. So it says in verse 12, not as Cain. And it shows here that he was influenced by one called the Wicked One. It caused him to murder his brother. Now, no one held a bow and arrow to Cain's head. They didn't have AK-47s in those days. He didn't just blow him away. He killed him. But no one had held anything to his head to make him kill his brother. But he wasn't thinking of his brother's welfare. He was thinking only of his own welfare. And so we're admonished that we should not live our life as Cain, who, in murdering his brother, was not thinking of the welfare of his brother. He was only thinking of the welfare of himself. Let's go to chapter 3 of Genesis, and we'll see this and hopefully learn a little about this generationalism again and this subject of making decisions and how far in the future we should think in making our decision. Genesis 3 and verse 15. God said to the serpent, I will put enmity between you, the serpent, and the woman, speaking of Eve specifically. And I will put enmity between your children and her children. He, the child of her, shall bruise your head, and you will bruise his, the son of Eve, at least speaking of it at that particular moment, will bruise his heel. So, Eve was told that she was to have a son who would bruise Satan's head. Now, we know from the reading the whole Bible that this was to be Jesus, but they didn't know that at that time. They thought that it would be their firstborn son who would do that. And, of course, he was Cain. So, we see in chapter 4 then, and verse 1, Adam knew, which is the polite King James word, meaning he knew his wife more intimately, and she conceived and bore Cain, her first son. Now it appears that Cain and Abel were twins because in verse 2 it said she bore again. It didn't say she conceived again, but she bore Cain and then she bore Abel. And it doesn't talk about conception except for one time. Cain knew his wife, conceived, and bore Cain, and said, Eve said, I have acquired a man from the Lord. Now this has been disputed and discussed. I make the statement here that Cain thought he was God or thought he was above the rules because he was something special. Because his mother had been taught that he, Cain, would bruise Satan's head. That's all they could take from that. They didn't know Jesus Christ was coming along thousands of years later. Eve said when Cain was born, I have acquired the man. I've got what God promised. I have this being, this son, who's going to solve our problems. This, she said, is what God promised. Well, with that type of idea being put into his head, and we've seen things on a smaller scale of people who were told they were above others, they were above the law. They grow up thinking that they don't have to live by the law. They are God. They make the law. It would appear that Cain grew up thinking that he was God, that is, in the sense that he was above others. Because you find in verse 3 that something he did, a decision he made, was not exactly kosher, and it didn't seem to make any difference to him. In the process of time, well, we read in the latter part of verse 2, Cain was a tiller of the soil, Abel was a keeper of sheep. They were different in their occupations. In the process of time, Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. Now, it's been debated and discussed if they both brought the same thing or if they brought different, or what were the terms of these offerings that were brought. It says, Abel also, and appears to, by the word also, that he brought the same that Cain did. He also brought of the firstborn of his flock. It has been said that he also brought an offering, the special offering, but he also brought this firstborn of his flock, which of course involved sacrifice and realized that he needed to sacrifice. In one way, whether the one or both ways has been explained, you will find that it says Cain didn't have as righteous an offering, or that Abel had a, I don't know if you use the word superior, but his offering was respected and Cain's was not. Now, God is not an unjust God. He didn't have prejudice against Cain. He didn't have prejudice toward Abel. He is a righteous God. You cannot bribe God. So there was something wrong with what Cain did, or the attitude in with which he did what he did. It says that God did not respect Cain's offering, and he did respect Abel's offering. And you will find in verse 5, Cain was angry and his countenance fell. He pouted. Wow. He did not have respect for God. He could have said, well, I'm sorry, I really didn't understand, and I'm sorry I did that. But his countenance fell, and in verse 6, God said to Cain, why are you so angry? He was angered at God because God hadn't respected his offering. Remember, if it is true that he was the one they thought to be the one to bruise Satan's head, then all his life, and this may have been 15, 20 or so years, that he had this idea about himself that he was above the rules. He was going to be the one to solve all the problems. And when God didn't like what he had done, Cain was very angry and his countenance fell, and God had the audacity to ask him, why are you so angry? And here is a very, very important point. And it's hard to understand and it's hard to accept and live by. If you do well, you'll be accepted. But if you don't, now Cain was not accepted. It said, if you don't, sin lies at your door. It's desirous for you and you have to rule over it. He was preaching the gospel to him. You need to change your ways. But that didn't do any good for Cain. He thought that God was unfair. And so you will find that because of his temper, because he had been dissed and he couldn't control his own temper, he killed his brother in verse 8. In the field, Cain rose up and killed his brother. Now, thinking about seven generations or many generations, and our actions will affect others that follow along. He murdered his own brother. What was he thinking? How far ahead did he look when he made that choice? No one held a gun to his head and made him kill his brother. But he was angry. He didn't respect God for what God had said. He was going to do it his own way. Or in other words, in modern parlance, he did not and did not intend to follow the rules. So he killed his brother. John said he was influenced when he did that. He listened to that unseen influence that comes in through our ears into our mind and helps us. We don't think help, but it does cause us to make choices that affect other people's lives. And so when asked in verse 9, where is your brother? He said, I don't know and I don't care. Am I my brother's keeper? He lied to God, so he made another decision to tell a lie. And you will find in verses 11 and 12 that what he did brought certain conditions into his life and his future children's life. Now, the King James uses the word curse. That's a little strong word. But we will say God explained to him that there would be personal and future consequences in his life, in his family, in his genealogy, because of what he had done. He didn't think of any future consequences. He merely said to God, my punishment is greater than I can bear. In other words, he said, you're unfair, it's your fault. Now in verse 16 it says, Cain went out from the presence of God and dwelt in the land of Nod. That sounds like a nondescript little item about what happened in his life. But he went away from the presence of God. I've asked myself the question sometimes. We read in the Bible that the three sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, repopulated the earth. How, if that's true, and it was, how is it that some people have wound up in the backwoods, in the outback, in the most unlikely places that humans should ever even want to live, but they live there, and they're still made in God's image, they still have a wonderful brain, but as far as education and certain other things, they are backward, and they do not have the blessings of other nations. Why? No one forced them to do that. It said here, Cain went out from the presence of God. When you leave the tabernacle, or you leave the temple, or you leave the Holy of Holies, when you go away from God's presence, then you have to come up with a new philosophy of your own to live your life. You have to come up with a new set of rules. If you go away from God's presence and you're not willing to follow His rules, then you've got to make your own. And that is what Cain did. He went away from the presence of God. And then you'll find he married one of his sisters, we assume. There were no other women. He built a city, named it after his son, and then you'll find that a lot of things took place. And in verse 23, it talks about Lamech and his wives, and in verse 24, if Cain, he said, shall be avenged sevenfold, then I'll be 77-fold. And then it seems to say in verse 26, Adam and Eve had another son. They called his name Seth. And Seth also had a son, and they named his name Enosh. And then this just nondescript statement said, then men began to call on the name of God. It is, I believe, the Companion Bible that says, and it falls in line with what going to the outback, going away from the presence of God, and skipping chapter 5, going into chapter 6 about all the things that happened on the earth and how bad it got. It appears to say in chapter 4, verse 26, then men began to call themselves by God's names. Somewhat like Cain thought he was the one to take care of Satan, that he was above the rules and that he was God. He was what God had promised. You find that the generations got worse and worse and worse, like their forefather Cain thought he was. They had similar thoughts. They now called themselves by the name of God. Now, if you skip chapter 5 and come to chapter 6, because 5 is just a genealogy of Adam leading up to certain times. In chapter 6, in verse 1, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, daughters were born to them. The sons of God saw the daughters of men, and they took wives whom they chose. They did not like the rules. They lived above the rules. And that's when God said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever. I know his flesh, but he's not got long. And you will find that this is the culmination of 1,600 years from one family to the next, generational, 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 and God finally had to start over because no one had broken the mold. And he chose one man who had chosen to live by God's ways, Noah, and started over. Cain didn't think very far, and he wasn't considering the children that would come after him. the sweet and lovely little innocent things born to him who would someday be affected by what he had done, and their lives would be impacted because of what he had done. I can say that I've done things now, looking back, wishing that I hadn't done, but as I did it, I wasn't considering many more people other than Vernon Hargrove. And I see there are things that I have done that have affected our children. Even, well, I mentioned in the subject of human nature that from what we taught about where human nature came from, that God put something evil in us, and I believed that and lived by that, then my decision impacted the lives of my children because they thought God was that way. Because that's how their father was. And I was creating generationalism in a way. Thankfully, it was changed and we've learned differently. Let's look at the other side of this, though, because I don't want to go on and on and on about the negative aspect of this, because that's the gospel of gloom and doom, because you can find many, many, many places in the Bible where decisions were made by an individual who wasn't thinking very far ahead, and his children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren suffered. You know, Jeroboam was one of those where he changed the feast and brought in his own priests and made different feasts, and it caused Israel to sin, and God drove them into captivity, and they have never recovered from that yet. Our nation still suffers from that. But I don't want to dwell on gloom and doom. That is negative, and our life should not be negative. It should be positive. There is another side, and this is the wonderful side of this generationalism. There is another side to that great law of God, and it is a positive side. And I believe that positive side is extremely important for the building of our faith today. Let's go back to Exodus 20, verse 5. I didn't finish that verse for a deliberate reason. Exodus 20, and we'll start in verse 5. The first half says, you're not to bow down to this God. If you do, or to the false God, it'll be to the third and fourth generation. But verse 6 says, but I will show mercy to thousands of those who love me and follow my rules. Now that's a promise. That is an absolute, and it is just as automatic, it is just as much a living law as the first. Many have learned by cruel experience that verse 5 is true, that there is generationalism, that it does affect our children and grandchildren of the third, fourth, and fifth, and sixth generation. And so we are so discouraged, we don't have the strength to see the other half, the positive side of that. It says he will show mercy to thousands of those who love God, who live by and teach the right rules. It can be just as generational in a positive way as it was in the negative way, this time with good results, and we should be excited and thrilled to know that God's way is that way. Now, I know that we all know that God has to invite into his truth who he chooses. But if we who know the truth live an exemplary life, and if we do teach the proper ways and rules, who knows? Who knows the health and wealth of those that follow us? Timothy did not have a father to guide him in the truth. Paul talked to Timothy about his mother and his grandmother, who taught him. Now, some would say, well, you know, if you don't have a father to teach you, then you can't really be a man. Timothy was a man, but he wasn't a man in the Grecian or Roman gladiator format. But he was a man. He had been taught the rules. And there are three generations, Timothy, his mother and grandmother. And who knows what Timothy did in influencing others. I don't know that he ever married, but I'm sure he influenced many people by his actions and his decisions. Excuse me. We can perpetuate one generation after another generation. We can be the one who breaks the mold if we make a determination to follow the rules and worship God and not bow down to another god and worship that god. We will not be cut off from the right rules. We will not be sent to the outback. We will live in God's presence. So that being the case, how far ahead do we look? Do we look just to our children? Our grandchildren also? Our great-grandchildren? When we make decisions of money and other things, do we look to our great-great-great-grandchildren? When we make decisions, do we think about or have in mind our future generations? Who we marry, when we marry. If we take steroids, will that affect our sons and daughters? If we use drugs, will that affect our children? If we have a child out of marriage, will that affect our children, the way they look at us and their brothers and sisters? If I don't provide for my family and I make the decision not to do it and not blame others for my poverty, will it affect my family? As a mother, if you don't nurture your children, will that affect the way they grow up? Think about God's promise, that wonderful promise. He will show mercy to thousands and thousands and thousands of those who love Him and live by His rules. He promised that. You know, your child wants to go do something and they say, and we say, "Oh, shut up and get out of my way. I don't have time for that." "But Daddy, you promised." "I know, but God promised. God promised that He would do that for us. And we can claim that promise that if we follow His rules, it will affect our genealogy." In a small way, I have been reminding God of that. You heard me say that we didn't just move back to Columbus to come to Columbus, and I don't mean that negatively, because I love Columbus and the people in Columbus, but I made the choice, Lee and I made the choice to return to Columbus because that's where our family was. And I wanted to see if I could make some changes from the things I had done that I should not have done. And we've seen wonderful results in a year and a half. Because I claimed God's promise and I asked God for help because of generationalism on the positive side. I'm not bragging about what I've done. You've heard me also say, it ain't bragging if you've done it. But I just want to say that I have learned both sides, and I prefer most greatly the positive side where God's promises kick in. We call Abraham the father of the faithful for a reason. You will find that he was a father of the faithful in Hebrews 11, verse 17, a reason why he is called that. Hebrews chapter 11, and verse 17 speaks of Abraham, where it said, "When he was tested, he offered Isaac, and he received the promises offered up of his only begotten son. He believed that God could raise him," and you find that God was able to even raise him from the dead. Then in chapter 11 and verse 10, why was he able to do that? It said he waited, and I believe in other versions it said he looked forward to. In the New King James, Abraham waited for the city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. He looked that far into the future. He knew who God was. He knew what God was doing. He knew that the promise God made was marvelously wonderful, and he knew if God asked this, then it had to be right in certain ways, and he was having faith in God, and he made his decision accordingly because he had a long-term view of the situation. And our lives, physically and spiritually, are and have been enriched because of what Abraham did. I call it generationalism, because Abraham did that. And of course, the ultimate, you will find a decision that was made that was done in the light of generationalism is in Matthew chapter 26, verse 42, where Jesus had to make a decision. And he was the only one that could make it. The Father wouldn't make it. James and John couldn't make it. No other human being could make it. It had to be made by Jesus Christ. In Matthew 26 and verse 42, he said, "Father, if this is the only way that our plan can be accomplished, then I will do it your way. I will make that decision." Now, before he made that decision, you'll find in verse 39 where he said that. In verse 30, just a minute, I'm lost in this page. Oh, in verse 36, yeah, Jesus said, "Sit here while I go and pray." He told the disciples, "I have to talk to God about this. I've got to make a decision, and I need to talk with God first." That helps us to make the right decision when we just talk to God about his plan. He knew he had to make it. No one else could make it. And he said, "Okay, if that's the way it has to be, that's the way I will do it." And he did it. And you'll find that he confirmed the promises to Israel and to all nations because of what he did. And it says in Hebrews 12, too, that he did that because of the joy that he knew would come because of his decision. I don't know if you've ever experienced it or not, but if you experience joy and great satisfaction in knowing that you played a part in the success of your family, your children and grandchildren, that you have great satisfaction because you know their lives have been not impacted, but blessed and honored and have been uplifted because of the decisions that you made, thinking of them also. But we don't always do that. Why don't we look beyond and consider that? Well, we are told not to be like Cain. He was full of ego and self-centeredness and unwilling to delay the gratification, and he suffered and his children suffered. As people who follow the great law of the God of creation, not the great law of the Iroquois people, but as people of the great God who created the universe, we need to think in long term, that is, seven generations, many generations, for all eternity. Whether we believe it or not, whether we like it or not, what we do, that is how we live, will affect those generations who come after us. You may not believe that, but that doesn't make any difference. It will affect them. Yay or nay, negative or positive. And of course, the unfortunate part is the implied meaning of generational usually means negative or bad results. But as I said, it can also mean wonderful results for many, many generations to come, including many, many people. I was stopped still in my tracks when I saw that detergent box with the quote on it. Now I'm thinking, if the great law of the Iroquois Indian Confederation spoke of making decisions with seven future generations in mind, then we who follow the great law of the Almighty God should strive to make decisions with many, many future generations and all eternity in our mind. If we do this, then we and the future generations will profit greatly if we do that. Just a quick thing, and I'd like to end with a poem by Will Drumgoole. It's called The Bridge Builder. You may have heard it before. An old man going a lonely highway came at the evening, cold and gray, to a chasm, vast and deep and wide, through which was flowing a sullen tide. The old man crossed in the twilight dim. The sullen stream had no fears for him, but he turned, when safe on the other side, and built a bridge to span the tide. "Old man," said a fellow pilgrim near, "you're wasting strength with building here. Your journey will end with the ending day. You never again will pass this way. You've crossed the chasm deep and wide. Why build you a bridge at this eventide?" The builder lifted his old gray head and said, "Good friend, in the path I have come. But there follows after me today a youth whose feet must pass this way. This chasm that has been naught to me, to that fair-haired youth may a pitfall be. He too must cross in the twilight dim. Good friend, I'm building the bridge for him." Remember that you have to have everything out of here by 6:30. If not, it will be found in the lost place.